Welcome to this podcast of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at www.commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. You can also find Inforum on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Good evening, and welcome to the Commonwealth Club. My name is Martine Paris, and I'm the Electronic Arts Marketing Manager for the epic action RPG game Kingdoms of Amalur: Reckoning, and the producer of tonight's event, Video Stars Tell All, Pathways to Fame and Fortune. Well, we have an all-star panel with us tonight: David Prager of Dignation, Tara Long of Destructoid, Dan Brown of Dan 3.0, and Jack Conti of Pomplamoose. Moderating discussion is Jim Lauterbach, CEO of Revision 3, who has been praised by industry leaders, including investor Mark Cuban, for making online video profitable. And he knows this industry very well. He has a lot of great things to tell us about it. Prior to joining Revision 3, Jim was editor-in-chief of PC Week. He launched ZDTV's Tech TV, the first 24-hour cable network devoted to technology, and served as senior vice president and editorial director for Ziff Davis Media Consumer Group. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming our panel.
Hello, everybody. I'm Jim Lauterbach, CEO of Revision 3, and tonight we are going to dive into the economics of online video stardom and the revolution of web video distribution. We've gathered a really exciting group of online programming experts, video stars, and people who know a heck of a lot about this emerging space, and they're going to tell us all about how they are challenging big media, and guess what? They're winning, too. We're starting off with David Prager, who is one of the co-founders of Revision 3 and the producer of one of the most popular online video shows. It's called Dignation. It's a weekly tech show featuring the top dig stories with hosts and internet stars Kevin Rose and Alex Albrecht. He's worked as a segment producer for G4 Tech TV's show The Screensavers and also their show Attack of the Show, and was a producer and a writer for ZDTV. Our second panelist is Tara Long, and she is the host of Destructoid. This is the Revision 3 show for all things video games. She's also an associate editor at Destructoid.com, which is one of the world's largest independently owned video game blogs. And if you want to know anything about video games, you've got to go to Destructoid or ask Tara. Destructoid has reached over 1 million views since its launch just 5 months ago. Sitting next to Tara is Dan Brown. Dan Brown, the host of Dan 3.0, the 49th most subscribed director on YouTube with 274,000 subscribers, and is probably the most media savvy person I know under the age of 21. Any age. He's extremely media savvy. His video on how to solve Rubik's Cube has generated, get this, over 20 million views to figure out how to solve the Rubik's Cube. And finally, we're really lucky to have with us Jack Conti. Jack is half of the indie pop music duo Pomplamoose, which consists of Natalie Dawn, who's a singer and bassist, and Jack, who produces and does multi-instrumentalist stuff and pretty much everything else. Now, these guys are probably the biggest musical act most of you have never heard of. Over 50 million views on YouTube, contracts with major brands like Hyundai and Toyota, songs climbing the Billboard charts. They've been a hot news story for over a year on how to make it big, get this, without the backing of a traditional record label. So it's a great group. We're going to jump right into it. What I want to start with the group here is, how did you guys get into this? And let's start with David Prager, because you've been pretty much in this probably for the longest. You've been doing this Revision 3. I think you started Revision 3 almost 6 years ago. How did it start?
So I started my career in traditional television, in cable television, kind of small niche cable television. And through a pretty long story that I'll simplify, the company that I worked for was ZDTV, which was sold to Paul Allen, who co-founded Microsoft, turned into Tech TV. He then sold it to Comcast, who folded it into a smaller network called G4. Which turned the core programming of what Tech TV, which was primarily technology enthusiast stuff and geek culture stuff, into primarily just video game stuff. It left a lot of disenfranchised viewers when Tech TV ceased to exist. I had experience producing technology programming, and I had some friends who worked with me at Tech TV who had experience producing and hosting, so they'd built some fan followings. And so this is back in 2004. So we started, we went and worked for the new network, G4, because they brought several employees down. At the same time, we kind of hobbied around in creating kind of underground hacker little videos, like little shows. This is before there was iTunes podcasting, before there was YouTube and any of that. So what we did is we used the, you know, the video equipment that we had and some of the simple editing equipment that we had, and we compressed the videos and put them out online and promote them a little bit before most of the media, the social media tools that exist now were there. There was no Twitter, there was no Facebook. There were, you know, people could start a website. I don't even think the word blog really even exists then, but people were obviously been using the internet since 1995. So we put out this stuff and found that, you know, we were luckily creating content that was for early adopters, meaning people that were interested in possibly watching a video on their computer are people that happen to be technically savvy enough to do it, and also the people that are technically savvy enough to do it happen to be interested in technology content. So we kind of hit a fortunate circumstance in making stuff that we're interested in, which is technology stuff, putting it out there and promoting it using the existing star power of people like there's a guy named Kevin Rose who's also co-founder of Revision 3, and he'd build up an audience through traditional media, through traditional television, to help promote, hey, here's this cool little thing that we're putting out online. We saw that there were tens of thousands of people watching that, realized that we could maybe make more of it and get more than tens of thousands by continuing to keep doing it, and thought, well, maybe we can see that we have an audience. Maybe we can figure out what the demographic of the audience is. Once we figured the demographic, we thought, well, who's interested in reaching that from a traditional advertising perspective, sponsorship perspective, threw out to some kind of niche sponsors, people that had really specific types of products that we thought would reach our audience that we were able to approach individually without really the model of large brands and agencies. So we'd hit up individual companies saying, hey, this is what we have. Can we try something with you? We struck a chord enough with a couple of them that we were able to get enough results that we were able to then take those results and go seek funding to quit our jobs and start a company. And I mean, that's, I guess, the long story short of how Revision 3 started.
And yeah, it's a great story of, you know, starting just because you wanted to and actually building a company out of it. Dan Brown, moving on to you, you are another, I mean, you're the youngest guy on the panel, but you're another old timer here. I mean, you've been doing it longer than just about anybody. Tell me, how did you get your start?
So I guess my very first start with online video would have been back in like 2004, 2005. I was heavily involved in the stunt pogo sticking community, and this was before the age of YouTube. So I edited together a video of me doing tricks on a pogo stick and uploaded it to I actually emailed it to my friend Dave, who ran a site called xpogo.com, and he just put it straight on Xpogo. So that was my first experience in online video. But my first experience in the whole world of YouTube and the world as we're more familiar with it now came when I was in high school, in between my junior and senior years. One of my buddies asked me he knew that I knew how to solve the Rubik's Cube. And so he said, how do you do that? And so I figured, I'll just make a video. I knew how to edit videos from my pogo sticking days. And so I put the video on YouTube, and in the first day, I think it got close to 35,000 views, which completely blew my mind. And now the video's in two parts, because back then you couldn't upload a video longer than 10 minutes. but part one has like 20 million views, and part two has somewhere close to 14 million views. So, I mean, it went viral in the truest sense of the word. And that's how I got my start.
Well, and you managed to build that into, you know, you didn't just say, wow, you know, that's how you solve a Rubik's Cube. Maybe I'll do my next video on how to solve an ant farm or something.
Solving an ant farm.
You actually built a real community around what you were doing, right?
Yeah, definitely. I decided to just keep going with it. I was filming on just a little dinky. It was meant to be a picture camera, but it had a video function, so I was just filming on that. I set it up on this old a tripod from the 1950s that my family had just lying around, and I began vlogging. I was really interested in politics, what was going on then. It was just before the 2008 presidential election, and when I started college, I was a political science major, so I did a lot of vlogs about that. And over
vlog being video blog.
Yes,
the way.
Sorry, I'm using terms that you may or may not be familiar with.
Cool. But, so Jack, amazing, you know, music that you guys are doing online and getting out there. How did that come around? You've been a musician for a while. How did you decide that, wow, I think if I put it on YouTube, I'll be famous?
Well, there was sort of a ding moment for me, at least. I was browsing my MySpace page, which had its usual three plays that day, and feeling rather down. And then I went over to YouTube and saw somebody playing guitar and singing into a camera. And they were, it was a cover of a song. I don't even remember what song it was. I don't remember what YouTube channel it was, but the video had, I think, 150 or 200,000 hits. And I toggled back over to my MySpace page, and I just thought to myself, I'm in the wrong place. So it was intentional from that point on. We shifted our focus toward video content and away from audio content, because we felt like that's where this emerging audience was.
And then, and what was the next step for you? I mean, you started out there, but then how did you get to the point of doing 50 million? I mean, how did you go from point A to point B?
Well, that was also another little bit of a ding moment for us. We had been producing content for about a year, covering songs that we liked and coming out with originals. And then somewhere in there, we realized that we should really be covering more popular songs, and that we could mooch off of other people's traffic. And so that was also very intentional. We started, instead of picking songs based solely on, you know, on our constraints, we would list all the songs we liked, and then we'd find the one with the most number of hits, and we'd do that one. And as soon as we started employing that strategy, we noticed our numbers getting a lot higher.
So imitation is not only the greatest form of flattery, it's a great way to build a career.
Indeed.
That's cool. Tara, a year ago, you were a medical researcher. Now you're hosting one of the most popular shows about video games out there. How did this happen?
Yeah, my story is actually pretty much the exact opposite of everybody else's here, because the show that I do now, Destructoid, is actually my first foray into the video, not only the video game industry, but also just web shows in general or anything in the limelight. I moved to San Francisco from Texas in January of last year, just in search of adventure. I had a telecommuting job working as a faculty member at the Virginia Bioinformatics Institute, which is where I did research. My contract ended later last year, and I just happened to meet Nero Gonzalez, who is the founder of Destructoid.com, when I moved to San Francisco. We became friends. Video games were something that I had always had an interest in, but I never would have considered, you know, making it my career. And he got approached by Revision 3, actually, to produce a show about video games, like a video game news show. And he came to me and said, I think you'd be great for it. Why don't you become an editor of the website, and let's see how this goes. So in July of 2010, I became an associate editor of the website. And then the show started last October. And things are going pretty well right now. We're still kind of in that ramp-up phase. So
doing quite well. I'm interested, you know, Dan, when you started doing this and you were in high school,
yeah,
what did your friends think of you? It's like, wow, he's got a video.
it was kind of strange. And the relationships that, you know, the friendships I had in high school, those were based on me before I was an online video personality, I guess. So it didn't actually change those relationships a whole lot, actually.
Yeah.
It stayed the same. It was just always something that we knew it was there, but it never was really the focal point of our discussions.
What about you, David? What did your parents say when you told them you were going to leave this lucrative job and go start some little thing in a basement about video online?
I had a pretty stable career for about 4 or 5 years. It was my first job out of college working for ZDTV and Tech TV, and then Comcast. I just kind of followed it down the way. I think they knew I wasn't very happy moving to Los Angeles, although I'm very fortunate to have done that because I learned a lot more about the entertainment industry and about Hollywood and LA and about how some of that works. I'm very fortunate, I think, to have had the experience down there, but I wasn't very happy with not having as much control, I guess, as over the content that I did, quite frankly, over a smaller cable network under a smaller company. So I just, as far as my parents are concerned, they always kind of known, I guess I'm lucky that I've always just done what I wanted to do, and they've always let me do that and supported me, and, you know, including, you know, I mean, I'm very fortunate to have, you know, I didn't have student loans. They helped me out with that. So, I mean, I think there's little things like that that helped me along. But they gave me the autonomy and trusted me, and sometimes it's good for your parents to trust you, and sometimes it's not. And hopefully, they made a wise decision and maybe raising me in a way that they could trust my decision making.
Jack, how do the other musicians that you know who haven't gone down the path you've gone down, are they jealous? Are they looking at you like, how did that happen?
Well, they've started to upload to YouTube and start to focus on video.
Now they're copying you, right?
Well, I mean, it's a common model among musicians now. It's getting more and more common. But yeah, certainly a lot of my friends who are musicians have seen what's happened and started doing the same thing, because it is a great model. It's certainly underutilized by record labels. You'd think they have all these resources and backing, and they haven't done anything like this. That's strange, yeah. But yeah, it certainly is becoming more of a common thing to do now.
And Tara, how about you? What the folks that you worked with in Virginia, what do they think about what you're doing? They think you're crazy?
I don't keep in contact with a lot of them anymore, just because they're halfway across all the way across the country, I guess. They all thought it was great. Last summer I mentored a bunch of students for work, and they were all so excited when I told them I would be doing this show about video games. They're all, you know, like in college and high school, so they just thought it was the coolest thing. And I've been fortunate to have a very supportive group of friends around me, and especially everybody at Destructoid. You know, the website is so supportive, and it's really been helpful.
So let's talk about the audience for a minute. First of all, any of you guys been recognized on the street for what you're doing? People come up to you and ask you to sign their shirt or something? So talk about it. Tell me. Give me a story.
Every once in a while it'll happen with me. I was a student at the University of Nebraska, and a couple of times on campus I'd be walking around and someone would say, you taught me how to solve the Rubik's Cube. I'm like, cool.
How'd that feel? Was it weird or was it good? Or was it just like, leave me alone, you weirdo?
It was nice. It really, like, I would be lying if I said that I didn't enjoy the attention a little bit. But it happens like once a month, if that.
So, Jack?
Yeah, it happens relatively often. Probably, you know, a couple times a month. It's fun.
What are you, Tara? You're saying yes.
Well, our show is still pretty new, so I'm not that out there yet. But I've been recognized at a few like a video game events that we go to just as part of our work. People say, "Hey, I watch your show."
Yeah, get used to that. You'll be the queen of the video game.
I don't know about that. You may not want
to be, but it'll happen. Definitely the Lord of the Geeks, which is those of us like David. You remember at Tech TV when we were doing Tech TV and we were reaching out to the technology audience, and we would go to an event and they would be like, they're like, oh yeah, you're one of us.
It's an interesting, because I was talking earlier about the early adopters, and what's interesting about the early adopter technology enthusiasts is, and I guess I'll be a little bit biased, but a lot of the technology enthusiasts are pretty smart people, and I was always thrilled to see how intelligent so many of our fans are. So I thought that was really neat. I've been mostly behind the camera, mostly on the producer side of things. I think most of my exposure is just from being somewhat of a face for the company, as well as being kind of an off-camera personality for the Dignation show, so people hear my name and they know it. So it is gratifying to get the acknowledgement, I guess, from, you know, having people see you. I mean, I've got colleagues that'll tenfold me on being recognized, though, which I love even more. I love it when I'm with a colleague or a friend of mine who's a big star, and I love having them get recognized, because it just, you know, affirms what you're doing.
Well, let's talk about the relationship with the audience for a minute. Think about traditional television stars. Now, I met Walter Cronkite once, and it was like meeting the Pope. I wanted to kiss his ring. You know, cable stars maybe a little bit more approachable, but still, they're, you know, if you were sitting having dinner with them, they'd do all the talking, and you'd probably be like, wow, I'm talking to this cable. So is it a different relationship with the audience with web video, or is it? Do you still feel like you're on a pedestal? Dan, why don't you start?
Yeah. I think a lot of it depends on what you're doing with web video. I mean, YouTube and platforms, all it is, in a nutshell, is a new platform. So, but what one thing that's interesting about platforms like YouTube is it opens up the possibility for vloggers, the sort of thing that, you know, I've been doing. And there's eye contact. You don't get that on television. On television, it's mostly just actors, and they're doing their own thing. Or even in a reality show, it's not being addressed directly to the audience, where on YouTube, for the first time, we're seeing an audience being directly addressed by whoever's hosting it, and it creates a sense of familiarity between the audience and the content creator. So, like, when I go to a YouTube gathering and I meet viewers, the viewers will come up to me as though they're my friend. They're like, hey, Dan. It's like, hey, nice to meet you. But, like, they already feel like they know me.
So, you know, musicians perform on stage, and the stage is there's a wall between that and the audience. You don't perform on stage. I mean, well, you know, when you're on YouTube, you're not on stage. Has that changed the relationship with you and the audience, do you think?
Definitely, absolutely, yeah. And also, because we add vlogs, people get more of an insight into our personal lives than I think a lot of other musicians. We really open things up, so people are in our kitchens and in our living rooms and outside the house, and, you know, people see everything, all aspects of our lives, not just the music. But I think the thing that distinguishes web video from television is that instantaneous feedback. I mean, you have ratings on television, and you have some sense of viewership and who's watching and demographics, but, you know, I'm sure Dan knows this. When you upload a YouTube video, 5 minutes later, you have 100 comments and people telling you whether or not they liked the video and what they liked about it and which parts were their favorites, and that's such a valuable thing for a content creator to have. That sort of two-way dialogue, I think, informs the relationship when you do actually meet someone, because they're used to voicing their opinion and talking to you. It's not uncommon for them to have something to say.
Well, Tara, you've been discovering this, recently with some of the things you told me, telling me a story today about how you were dressed in a particular way on one episode, and that caused some interesting comments that caused you to dress in a different way on the night. Explain this to me and how it happened. Give me a sense of what that was like.
On our third episode, I wore a shirt that I did not realize showed my bra when I leaned forward. So everybody saw it on camera. All of the comments on YouTube were just literally just the word boobs. So I thought, okay, well, let's just flip this around on them. And so the next episode we did, I wore like a full body space suit that my boyfriend actually happened to have as a Halloween costume. And I just wore it for the entire episode. And people loved it. What you have to do is, like, you have to interact with the audience in a way that shows them that you're listening to their comments. Because the interesting thing about YouTube is that people are very vocal because they can be anonymous about it, you know? Like, they'll leave you the nicest comments in the world, but people will just leave you horrible negative comments. And you have to learn to take the criticism in with everything else, and you have to play into it, almost, like we did with the spacesuit. You can't pander to people, you know, because they'll know. But it's important to establish, like, kind of a more intimate relationship with them, and on our show we do that through inside jokes.
What did the audience react to when you had the spacesuit on?
They thought it was hilarious. I was like, people, this is going to be our lowest viewing episode. Like, there's no skin at all. And people, like, we got 5-star reviews on our iTunes podcast that just said spacesuit on it. People really liked
from
it.
From boobs to spacesuit.
Yeah, exactly.
And they really like both, I'm sure. David, the Dig Nation audience, very vocal. I had one of the fans of Dig Nation said, it's not a fan base, it's a friend base, because everybody is friends with each other. Live versions of Dig Nation, when they do Dig Nation tapings, upwards of 3,000 people show up. What's it like to manage an audience of 3,000 friends?
Well, I think the friend base is because so the show Dig Nation, it's honestly, I'll just say, it's one of the easiest shows to do, and it's very personality driven. But the show's basically it's two guys sitting on a couch, having a couple beers, basically, I'll just say, trash talking the latest technology stories, and sometimes, you know, telling things about their personal lives and hanging out, discussing things, and it makes it feel like they're hanging out with the audience, having a discussion with them and laughing and joking. So they laugh and joke with each other and talk about things that their audience can relate to. And so I think it makes it seem like they're having a conversation, you know, making the eye contact that we were talking about earlier. So whenever we, since the show really is just guys sitting on a couch drinking beers, talking about technology stories, that formula is very easy to take that couch and the camera and go set it anywhere, whether it's on a huge stage or whether, I mean, we did it, I think we did the show sitting in line at the Apple store before the original iPhone came out, where just the camera's flying across all the people in line, all of a sudden it's these two guys that are people are used to seeing on the Dignation show doing that. And so it's very fun to be able to interact with fans in person as well. And so we have a conversation online, but then it's very easy to continue a lot of that conversation in person.
So there is traditional television has discovered this thing called social networking, and they're really actually very excited now about social TV. The idea that when you're watching your traditional television show, you've got Twitter and Facebook and other means set up so that you're actually interacting with other people while you're watching television. They've just discovered this. This is something that that you guys have just been doing. It's kind of by second nature. Is social TV something that interaction as it's going on a big driver of what you guys see as the success, or is it another thing that traditional television has glommed onto that they'll try for a while, spit up, and throw out because it doesn't really work? Anybody want to take on social TV? Jack, you're smiling. Go ahead. What do you think of social TV?
I'm actually, until now, unfamiliar with the term.
But you know what it is, right? It's like you're watching and...
It seems like it makes sense. Yeah, no, I can see that going places. It certainly works on the internet, and there have been iterations of that in the past to a certain extent. I mean, American Idol has you text in, you know, your favorite whatever, or you can tweet them now or however you do it. So, I mean, there've been attempts at feedback on television. I don't see why it couldn't totally flip around, especially when I think television is probably moving toward the internet anyway. I think I just saw an ad with HBO you can subscribe to HBO on your laptop, so you get all the content that HBO offers over the internet. And I think those lines will start to blur between television and computers, and as they do, I think it's only going to be natural that there's going to be that instantaneous feedback on a regular basis for shows.
And I think that technology, not just online video, but just in video entertainment in general, I think that the technology allows people to have conversations with other people that are interested in that show, whether it's a Dignation type show or whether it's the show Lost. I think actually, quite frankly, Lost, which ABC did a fantastic job of creating ancillary content surrounding the actual storyline of the show, creating websites about the companies that were involved in the plot of the entire series. I think they did a fantastic job, and they couldn't have done, you know, if you're a hardcore fan of a show, you can do everything from just watch the formal episodes of a show to participate in a whole pile of ancillary content and having conversations with not only like the hosts to the producers to just additional stories surrounding surrounding a plot line, whether if it's fiction or not. And so it's really neat being able to take advantage of technology to allow conversation as well as just this ancillary content, I'll call it.
So go ahead, Dan.
And one thing that I'd just like to add about TV versus internet content is that as soon as you're on television, you're in front of an audience of thousands, where as soon as you're on YouTube, it's like it's just whoever happens to stumble across it. But if you watch someone on YouTube from when they're getting 10 views to when they're getting 100 views to when they're getting 1,000 views to when they're getting 100,000 views, there's a real sense of intimacy. It's like, I've been here from the beginning. And with television, you don't really have that beginning. If that makes sense.
So, yeah, and what you have is your community. I mean, all media is about community. The internet is just community on steroids. I think what's interesting, though, is if you talk to a traditional television host, they, you know, may spend a half hour a week answering viewer mail. How much time, Dan, how much time do you spend interacting with your community as a percentage?
Well, I mean, it's kind of hard to put it in terms of percentage because it is just my life. but I mean, I'm on Twitter multiple hours a day responding to at replies. I have a public email address. I have a Facebook page. I mean, I'm constantly managing these things, and I'm responding to comments on YouTube videos. So, I mean, I guess as a percentage, I would probably say 30%.
30%, Jack.
I would say less than that, and we're trying to keep it, as strange as it sounds, we're trying to keep it to a minimum. Part of the trick, I think, for content creators is balancing communications with content creation. And for me and Natalie, writing songs is ultimately how we want to be spending most of our time. So we've had people help us with email and answering questions and putting up facts. I'd say we try to tweet, respond to tweets, Facebook, respond to some Facebooks, but we certainly don't do that more than maybe 15 minutes a day, 10 okay. minutes a day.
Tara, you're both a journalist playing games, writing about them, and also being on video. How about you? How much time do you think you spend interacting with your community versus doing the primary? And maybe they're both primary.
I give back about what the community gives me. So anytime anybody tweets me anything, I'll respond to it. You know, I try to spend as much time interacting with people as I can because I know that once the show takes off and starts getting bigger, I'm not going to have as much time for things like that. But I want to establish like a good user base now. People who feel comfortable watching the show and talking to us, people who ask our opinions on video games, it's all good. I'll respond to anything anybody asks.
David, what's your sense about building the community? How did the Dig Nation community build to the, you know, huge juggernaut it is now? What kinds of things did you guys do to help build it?
I think it was there's something to be said for consistency. I think for Revision 3, one of the things that solidified it as a company or as a network or as a media company was just the fact that Dig Nation was the first show that we had that had a consistent schedule where everyone knew there would be a piece of content at a specific time and day even. Not that we would be putting it out live, but that they'd know it was always there. It legitimized us on being able to build an audience because they knew it would keep on coming. The more stuff you put out, the more potential for more audience there is. And then in addition to that, just to hit a little bit on the business side, that when you have consistency and predictability, you can start to market that to people that are willing to pay to reach the audience.
You know, another interesting aspect of it, and let's talk about money a little bit, and maybe we'll cycle back into community if we have time. We're all in this. You know, we're not just in it for fun anymore, right? I mean, all of you are living real lives and have real careers doing this, doing what you enjoy. I guess I'll start with it. You know, can you make money at this and have a life?
Yes.
Jack?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Natalie and I quit our jobs about 2 years ago, and we're pretty much going off of record sales and then also partnerships with companies and licensing songs.
Well, so you talk about record sales. You don't have a label, so you're producing them yourselves.
That's right.
Right? And you talk about sponsors. Let's talk a little bit about sponsorships because certainly internet video has traditional ads, right? You've got sort of pre-rolls and overlays and things like that. But a lot of the real money in many ways seems to be these sponsorships. So what's working for you and how does that work?
Yeah, if I could also touch on something interesting you said there, which is that the real money seems to be in sponsorships. I think that's while that is true now to some extent, it's going to be more and more true in the future, especially for musicians, as we see iTunes switch over to a subscription program instead of an a la carte download program. I think media is going to be more like a utility in that you'll be paying a monthly subscription for an all-you-can-eat experience. And so unfortunately for a lot of artists, especially recording artists, that doesn't add up to as much money as it would be if you were selling individual MP3s. So the music industry right now is in quite a bit of trouble trying to figure out how to balance this new model with the old model. And I think one of the answers is going to be publishing and licensing and corporate sponsorships. So for us...
Go ahead. Here's what I'm interested in. So who sponsors you guys and how does that work? Do you like work them into a song? You're doing a great song and all of a sudden you'll say, hey, it's brought to you by McDonald's, and then you'll go off in the song again? Or how does that work?
hopefully not McDonald's. We try to be selective about who we work with. We don't accept every offer. We don't turn down every offer. We're not one of those indie anti-corporate bands. In fact, we're quite the opposite. We are excited about the new model of working with corporations and corporate America as this Medici family, this modern Medici family who's sponsoring and funding artists. So for us specifically, it's taken the form of licensing music to companies like Toyota. We had a song in a Toyota ad, or making commercials for a company. We have no allegiance. Obviously, we did a Hyundai as well. So, and for them, we did the commercial start to finish. So it was an audio and a video package. We filmed the ads, recorded the music for the ads, things like that. Then we also have, for a while, we're getting sponsored through Electroharmonix, which is a pedal company, getting sent pedals and gear, things like that. We have another, company that approached us recently. Samsung is interested in doing an online internet. They want a viral video. And
Don't they all?
Everybody wants a viral video. It's always funny when people say that. But so it takes the form of those kinds of events.
Dan, what's working for you?
The show that I'm doing now, Dan 3.0, we're experimenting with ad integrations in a way that I have never done before. But basically the format is I do 3 episodes a week. Every episode has a sponsor. And the idea is that, okay, the way that the show works is viewers tell me things to do. Viewers then vote on all the other submissions that other viewers have submitted, and then I do the highest rated ones. So back in November, December of 2010, I went on a cross-country road trip. And so sticking with the automotive sponsor theme, we were sponsored by Ford. That's just one example. We've had lots of other sponsors, but
yeah, and you actually had a Ford. You drove around the country on this cross-country tour in a Ford.
Yeah, they gave us a Ford Fiesta to tote around the country in, and it made a lot of sense because the audience, I mean,
not a Mustang. You're right. It wasn't a Mustang. It was a Fiesta. But the Fiesta is an awesome car, by the way.
My demographic probably couldn't afford a Mustang, so.
So Terry, you're a journalist. I mean, you're writing reviews of these games, and I assume that there are game-oriented things that are being sponsored inside the show. How do you balance that? How do you balance the trust issue with the sponsorship issue?
Well, our sponsorships from the show are specifically for the show, meaning we can't have most of our sponsorships on the show are for video games. Like we recently had Dead Space 2. We can't do that for the website because it would make us seem biased, basically. We can't, you know, because they review games on the website. We don't really review games on our show. We just talk about the news. So all of our sponsorships, like Dan, it's a thrice weekly show. All of our sponsorships are organized through the lovely people at Revision 3, and that's how we do it. It's interesting.
Yeah, David, the Dig Nation was a very early adopter of this sort of sponsorship model. Mm-hmm. In many ways piloted, you know, we've been doing this since Howdy Doody in the 50s and the Hallmark Theater and things like that. But, you know, bringing it into the web video world is something that Dig Nation did really early and has done a lot of them. Mm-hmm. But not all of them were successful. I mean, I remember one from a large computer company with 3 letters, the first one's I, that they pulled out. I mean, what do you do there? You got a bunch of guys who are out drinking beer and, you know, being a little off color. How do you make that work?
There's a fine line to be drawn between editorial integrity and authenticity and being true to your audience and making sure that they know you are who you are and, you know, but you also treat your sponsors with respect. And then there's also the line of being who you are without crossing, you know, moral lines or just something that they don't want to be identified by with. So Dig Nation, I would call an explicit show. You know, they're dropping F-bombs a lot. And they're just being themselves. And so we've been able to have relationships with, you know, I think it was a big deal for us to get Anheuser-Busch to sponsor the show because, yes, it's an alcohol company, but, you know, they're a very conservative, you know, from St. Louis type of company. And they also have a lot of guidelines where, you know, there are certain things that can get them in trouble if they promote binge drinking, if they promote, you know, people talking about any manner of things that you might even find, you know, as a musician even, which we're not, but there's a lot of musical artists that might not be able to market certain things when they align themselves with certain corporate entities. So we're constantly thinking about how to fit things in and how to make sure that we're able to maintain our integrity as well as maintain the respect of the sponsors, but still be able to deliver those messages in a way that, you know, provides value and, you know, is something that the hosts of the show are able to promote authentically without, you know, acknowledging that they're being paid for it, but still, you know, giving the value back to the sponsor. So it's, I think it's always nice to have a line that you dance close to, because if you're always testing the medium and testing what you can do, you know, it allows you to, you know, be successful at, you know, being edgy.
Well, and trust is really important, and making sure that the audience is aware that this is, that there is a quid pro quo, that the shows are free and that you're getting this in many ways. The artist can do it because of the sponsorships, and being clear about that rather than, you know, because once you pull the wool over someone's eyes, I think that's where it becomes a real problem. So we're going to be taking questions from the audience soon, in just a couple minutes. So please line up at the mic if you have questions for us. I actually have a couple of quick things to ask you guys before we jump into that. First of all, and I just want to go down, starting, Jack, with you, ending with David, and then we're going to go the other way. What would you guys be doing if you weren't doing this? Jack, what would you be doing if you weren't doing this?
Oh, gosh. Probably, I'd probably be working as a freelance composer, video maker.
Dan, what would you be doing?
I'd be in school.
So web video caused him to drop out. It's a bad thing. What about you, Tara? What would you be doing?
I would probably either be in grad school, which is what I was doing back in Texas before I moved here, or I would be working for, I guess, a Silicon Valley company doing tech stuff. My original degree is in math, so that's what I've been trained in. It's what I know best.
David, how about you?
I originally wanted to be a journalist, and I think I would have stuck with I still want to be kind of a journalist now. I try. So I would be working in journalism in one way or another, for sure.
Okay, and then I'm going to start with you, David, and go down the other end. And so you guys have had some really good success at this point. This is a really emerging area with web video. I think there's a lot more success to be had. But think about it. What's your dream? Where do you want to be in 4, 5, maybe 10 years? I mean, Jack, do you want to be working at a record label? Dan, do you want a big-time network show? Tara, do you want to be editor-in-chief of GameSpot? David, do you want to be producer of the Today Show? I mean, what's the dream here? David, tell me what the dream is in 5 years.
I come from a kind of a different perspective. I always wanted to be a journalist, and then I turned into a businessman as well as a television producer. I mean, right now I'm excited about Revision 3 and wanting to build it into a large media company. That's what I'm excited about. Before that, my dream job growing up was to be a correspondent for 60 Minutes.
Cool. Tara?
I want to get rich and retire in 5 years and then travel the world. Is that an option?
That is an awesome dream. I'm with you on that one.
Part of what's been kind of exciting about my life is that I've done so many different things, and I'm honestly not constricted to the video game industry. So who knows? In 5 years, I could be, you know, working at an orphanage in Kenya. I've always wanted to just spread myself thin and go everywhere.
Cool. Dan?
I just want to be able to continue making video content, having fun doing it, and being able to support myself doing it. I mean, the sky's the limit, but I don't know. I feel like it's weird to try and predict where it would be.
And what about you, Jack?
Yeah.
I'd like to meet Oprah. No, we have a very simple goal, which is basically to be a self-sustaining, self-financed operation, be able to make the music that we want to make without someone dipping their creative toes into our bucket for the rest of our lives.
Cool.
Well, that was fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Jim Lauterbach of Revision 3, for hosting the panel portion of our program. For the listening audience, my name is Martine Paris, and again, I'm the producer of tonight's event. I'm also an Electronic Arts marketing manager, so I wanted to thank Tara for plugging Dead Space 2 for full disclosure. Awesome. Okay, and so now we're going to begin the portion of our program where we turn it over to the audience. So first question, please.
Hi, thanks for the program. I have a general question for all of you. Two questions. First of all, how are you reaching your international audiences? Because there's a whole global market. And then the second question is, how are you finding out what people are wanting to watch? Like, yes, there are the comments, but also, you know, before you, your initial content, you probably made some content no one saw, and then you gradually made more content. How did you do the research on what people want to watch?
I'll just hop in. A large part of it is just reading the comments that the audience has for you. You know, people are very honest about their opinions online, and a lot of it just requires you proactively listening to them and then changing things. Not changing your act based on what people want, but figuring out audience input and how to incorporate that into your show. We do that a lot. Like, we'll ask our audience, what video games do you guys want us to talk about, you know? And people will tell us, and we'll do it, and they'll make appreciative comments about it.
So, speaking from just the overall Revision 3 perspective, so we have our core audiences, just the people that are, you know, the primary viewers of any individual show or all the shows combined. And one of the things we'll do, and some of this is business driven and some of it's programming driven, is we will sponsor our own surveys and sometimes do third party surveys, and we'll promote those surveys on the site and in the shows and say, we'd really appreciate it if you could help us, tell us what you want, tell us what you're interested in seeing. If you take the survey, we'd really appreciate it. And it's great to have an authentic relationship, because we find that also we have a high percentage of the audiences of these shows will go through and take these surveys, and then the surveys will go across the board and just ask them fill-in-the-blank questions all the way down to how much of a show do you watch, how much do you don't watch, what do you see that you like, don't like, and then even ask them, of course, you know, if you're going to get them to do a survey and you're selling sponsorships, you ask them, you know, what their consumer behaviors are and all the way across the board. And we've been able to collect really valuable data on that to help both our sales team as well as, you know, what kinds of things and what kinds of content people are interested in seeing in the existing shows as well as in potential future shows.
And to answer the first part of your question about reaching international audiences, speaking from my own experience, in the show that I do, actually in the episode that went live today, I do a thing called Wall Wednesdays, where I just have a wall in my apartment that I just, people can mail me things from anywhere, and I put it up there. And so, I mean, I get mail from all over the world. I haven't done anything specific to reach out to an international audience. It's just, it's available to an international audience, and so the international audience watches it. I mean, particularly in English-speaking countries, as you can imagine, but I mean, literally everywhere there's someone.
Yeah, the nice thing about the internet is that the international audience sort of comes hand in hand with the local audience. So for us, that hasn't been too much trouble, except in the case where we're covering songs and trying to make an album available overseas. And there are various performance rights organizations that you need to get licenses from, things like that, and that becomes sort of difficult. But for the most part, reaching an international audience, I think, is relatively easy, especially, you know, on YouTube.
Jack, actually, I want to just do a follow-on to that question. I heard you speak at another panel about how you guys license all your covers through Harry Fox. I thought that might be helpful for the audience to understand how you can, you know, do hit songs and monetize it.
Sure, yeah. I mean, a lot of people think that you need sort of a lot of machinery in place to get a license to cover a song and sell it, and that's just not the case. It takes about 5 minutes on a website called Harry Fox. You buy something called a mechanical license. It allows you to record someone else's composition. And then to sell that, so you buy them, I think, 1,000 at a time. It costs about $100, and you have a legal permission to sell 1,000 copies of that song.
Yeah, fascinating. Okay, next question, please.
Hi, thanks for being here. You guys talked about establishing predictability and consistency. Could you talk about how you established it before you could talk to the sponsors about sponsoring you?
How we established the consistency?
And predictability. Yeah.
Well, as far as Dignation is concerned, I said earlier that it was a fortunate circumstance that it was easy to do. We sat two guys on the couch, put a camera on him, put some microphones on him. Kevin Rose, who was the co-host of the show, had started a website called Dig, and they had a lot of news story submissions. So the two hosts would pick stories and talk about them for a while and drink their beers, and on the camera we'd pretty much hit the red button and then do a little bit of post-production. So I think once that started, we set out with a goal of, like, let's just do this once a week. And I don't, all the business related things that I said earlier weren't necessarily in mind, but it just ended up being a very, very, very good idea. And so it was easy, luckily, to do. Other shows might take a lot more production. It would have taken more effort. We might have not you know, had the gusto to start doing that endeavor. But this one was sit on the couch, crack a beer open, and talk about these stories. So it was we were a little bit lucky and a little bit calculated. Yeah, a little bit of both.
Fantastic. Next question, please.
Hi, this might be best for Jim, but anybody's welcome to weigh in. Because the panelists, you guys talked a lot about your audience, tech savvy, mostly young, early adopters. Do you have any insights into how to be successful reaching a different demographic, like an older audience, for example?
Yeah, I think the best way to reach an older audience is to, you know, take a look at, first of all, who's doing what for that audience and what they're interested in, and then map your interests to their interests. And just start doing it. I mean, I think, you know, and everybody on this panel will probably agree with me that you can study something to death and you can think about it to death. Pick something that you're interested in. Pick something that you think is appropriate for that audience. Find out what that audience is already interested in and looking at, and build something complementary. And then I think from building an audience, once you've got something out there, then you start doing some of the cross-promotion stuff, which is, you know, another essential ingredient to what all these guys have done, which is how do you get yourself in front of other people who are similar.
But, you know, Jim, I have a question for you, actually. So two of the biggest audiences to monetize these days are young core gamers, male 14 to 25, or I think you say 13 to, what do you say?
13 to 35, because it rolls off the tongue better.
Yeah, and the mommies, right? So that's not your core audience. But, I mean, I think people that are producing content really are targeting those two audiences because that's where the sponsors want to be. Is that correct?
Yeah, it is. But if you think about it, there are sponsors for every audience segment and every audience. Look at what's happening with local and Groupon. And, you know, if you can find a core audience that's underserved and there are people that want to reach it, that's awesome. If you have a deep connection with an audience, it doesn't matter which audience it is. If you have a deep connection that's big enough, you can drive sponsors through that and into that. And yeah, look, the mommy blog area is really big because they're the, you know, now they're calling them the chief home officer or something like that. You know, the people who buy all the Pampers and the Bounty and everything like that, which, you know, I think is a huge, well, you've got to come up with some generalizations to reach an audience. But every demo has its own interests, has its own things that they will enjoy, has an appetite for this, and has sponsors that wants to reach it.
If I could weigh in on that as well, I was very surprised when I looked at our 2-year demographics on YouTube about a week ago, and half of our viewers, literally half of our viewers, are over 35 years old. And that was a huge surprise for us because I was thinking, oh, YouTube, it's going to be, you know, girls under 15 because we're covering Beyonce. it's not the case. We have covered some older songs, and I think that helps. We've covered the Cordettes, Mr. Sandman, Earth, Wind, and Fire, September. And so we've expanded our demographic simply by widening the types of songs that we're covering. Reaching into that extra crowd, I think, by you know, the same way you would reach into the younger crowd by covering something that's popular with them or covering something that's popular with them, I think is going to draw the audience from both sides.
I also think that the floodgates are just barely opening. 5 years ago, if we made a show about botany and made a show about chip fabrication, there are more people that are interested in botany, I'm sure there are, but you would have far more viewers on a show about chip fabrication because all those technology guys are already adept in grabbing the stuff and they're the early adopters. Now is like it's getting easier and easier and easier for people to consume online media content. The floodgates are opening for far more reaching different demographics and niches and passionate audience around things because they're able to consume that stuff more easily than they would have. So a show about, I mean, I'm just using an example, botany, it's probably going to get more viewers than a show about chip fabrication now. 5 years ago, the chip fabrication show online would have destroyed the botany audience.
You know, follow on to that, David. So the Revision 3 is brilliant at using SEO to drive content. I'm sure of it. I don't know this for a fact. I should actually ask this of Jim. But I notice a lot of your shows will have really highly searched items. And so I imagine that would draw traffic because you guys get your audience on YouTube, right, revision3.com and some other sites?
Well, you know, I don't think we're that – actually, it's nice of you to say that, but I don't think we're that good at SEO or even what I am now calling – YouTube is a search engine, but it's very different. I call it YTO, you know, YouTube optimization. There are people who are much better at it than we are, but we, you know, we try and do a good job there. And it's all about rising out from the clutter. There are so many things being produced. There's so much stuff out there. And how do you do that? Well, one is to make sure if people are searching for stuff they want, you come up in that first page of search results, whether it's on YouTube or Google or wherever. Another is doing, you know, what Jack does, which I think is awesome, which is, you know, songs that appeal to that audience. Another is what I know Dan has done really well, which is to go out and do videos with other people. I mean, he went and cut a song with the guys of the vlog, one of the vlog brothers, and they were in each other's video, and that turned the audiences on to each other. So a lot of different ways to do it. SEO and YTO are just one of the arrows in that quiver.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with serving up content for what people are looking for. I mean, that's the new way. Okay, next question, please.
My name is Mike, and I have a two-part question. One is on your proposals or how you approach your sponsors. Obviously, sponsors are a very important part. But, you know, when you hear sponsors back in the day, you might think, like, well, I'm going to approach a sponsor. I'm going to write a written proposal. I imagine since all of you are in the video world, maybe you have some new innovative ways that you're proposing or reaching out to your sponsors. And how are you doing that? The second part of the question is, you know, in driving traffic, to follow up on traffic, how are you using blogs, Facebook likes, collaborative filtering, Twitter to drive traffic? Because to some extent, SEO is a bit dated. I mean, you really have to compete with a lot of people to try to get your content up. But when you have Twitter out there, I'm curious as to how you go about using those. Thanks.
So on the first part of your question, early on for Revision 3, we would specifically approach potential companies specifically companies that we thought would be interested in the content. It's changed a lot in the past few years because it's being able to be seen statistically that more and more viewers are shifting from traditional television to online. And so those dollars that large agencies and brands are spending are actually shifting over as well. And so because of that, there's a lot of traditional stuff still going on. So the way that large agencies and brands will create RFPs, requests for proposals, they'll start reaching out to online entities and saying, hey, we've got this campaign for this company or a campaign for a client of ours, and we want to reach this many people with this kind of message. And they'll start reaching out to companies like Revision 3 and including them in the RFP process along with, you know, print and television and other places. And so what our sales team will do is look at their request for proposal, see how many people they're interested in reaching, and they'll look at what we have as inventory, and we'll come up with creative ideas that we think that we can represent their campaigns on our shows. And we've worked really hard to try to, you know, to go speak more on how the traditional thing works. Is a lot of selling is building relationships and working with clients and building those relationships so that you get those requests for proposals and then working on those proposals to be able to ultimately provide ROI, and you're still out there schmoozing and putting together stuff. So we're not sending video proposals out, but we're including elements of that from time to time and stuff that gets sent out in response.
So I have a question for the panel. You guys are all YouTube stars. I mean, pretty much all your shows live on YouTube. Would you say that's the where you get most of your audience? Okay. So now Facebook has, what, 650 million people now and just struck a deal with Warner Brothers, right? That was announced this week. So a lot of people are thinking, hey, you know, Facebook might be the next platform when TV goes away. And it's Facebook. I mean, we're all spending a lot of time on Facebook. So what's your thoughts on your shows living on Facebook, finding your audience there, literally like broadcasting from Facebook?
I've found that Facebook is really valuable for advertising our show. The Destructoid Facebook page has about 5,000 fans right now, but every episode that goes up, I post it on the Facebook, and Facebook has added a new feature now where it'll tell you how many impressions you have for each story. So even though Destructoid only has 5,000 fans, it shows me when I post an episode, it has received like 10,000 impressions because people are sharing it. So I found that social networks, Facebook, Twitter, all of it, it helps so much more than you think for spreading the word.
Jack, what about a Pomplamoose channel? I know you guys have a page, but I mean in terms of, you know, looking a year down the road when Facebook might be the new TV.
Right. I have to say I'm really a novice when it comes to Facebook. I haven't explored it as much as I probably should have. The idea of having it live on Facebook, I think, is absolutely fine. I mean, the medium really doesn't concern me. It's wherever the people are, I suppose, is where we'll be putting the show. So I probably am not going to be on the early adopter side of Facebook, but if it starts to become a platform like YouTube, where there's lots of people searching and going and looking for content and subscribing, then yeah, we'll be the 100 millionth to switch over.
Facebook's had the ability to upload videos for a while, but when you compare Facebook as a video platform compared to YouTube as a video platform,
at this point,
there's really no contest.
Yeah, not
YouTube
yet.
Is still better.
But we'll see how they evolve. It'll be interesting to see. Next question, please.
Thank you. I'm asking you, Jack. I'm obviously a little bit older than you are. I have people who have been producing CDs that are very musical. Kids hear it and they go, wow, that's really good. And I heard you say that you went off of MySpace, which is where we've got audio based, onto YouTube, which is video based. What do people who are in maybe a different era than you do to get people to listen to them, even though they're older and still feel the same way as the young people? Thank you.
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, the great thing about YouTube is that it's a wonderful place for niche markets. And I mean, that's sort of the great thing about the internet. I once heard somebody say, if you're one in a million on the internet, there are 10,000 of you. And that was really inspiring for me because, some of our music is, I would say, certainly not going to be as popular as Beyonce or Lady Gaga. It's just more niche market oriented. But the internet has allowed those people to make a living because on the internet there are enough people where even if you're one in a million, you can still have a following and people who will be interested in what you're doing. So though the older audience is smaller on YouTube, I wouldn't let that be a disincentive at all. I mean, like I said before, half of our followers on YouTube are over 35 years old. I think the trick is finding content that they're going to be interested in and figuring out how to use some SEO or YEO, YouTube optimization to draw those users in. One thing specifically I can tell you that we've done and we've noticed an improvement since then is instead of saying on our videos when we cover Nature Boy, for instance, instead of saying Pomplamoose, Nature Boy, Pomplamoose is our band, Nature Boy is a song, we say Pomplamoose - Nat King Cole. Because when you look at, when you search for Nature Boy on YouTube, Nat King Cole is the first video that pops up. And we were on page 4 or something, or whatever. But now if you search for Nature Boy, Pomplamoose, I think, is above the Nat King Cole version because it has more hits. And so the idea is you can use little things like that, little search terms and tags, and covering the right content to draw in, you know, your certain crowds.
That's great. Okay, well, we've come to that time in our program where we do have time for one last question, and that will be yours.
So I'm really interested about, like, demographics and consumer insights and how you guys actually track that. So through comments alone, I'm just thinking about my own usage as well as friends and, you know, a few companies that I've worked for. Generally, the people who comment may be your strongest subscribers or fan base, but they may also, more likely, through the case of like Yelp and small businesses, it's the people who are just really angry and, you know, are upset. So how do you have a strong sense of the people who may like your stuff, who may be actual subscribers but who aren't yet, and without making them irrelevant? And I'm thinking about a specific example. So Jack's music, I've actually heard about Transplant really recently from the East Coast. 1 a.m., a friend shows me in the rain your channel online, actually through my phone, so social media is working. She thought it was the coolest thing in the world. And I thought it was really cool, but I'm not a subscriber. She's really into vlogs. I'm sure she's a subscriber. But neither one of us, even though we thought it was really cool, I actually passed it on to, you know, 4 other friends that night. Did we comment? So, like, you have people who are interested, but how do you actually get the people to comment and know what to put out there in terms of content.
And so we have like 1 second for a response. Jack?
For us, we're not as quite as interested in comments as we are in record sales. And so we do have some statistics. You know, we know how many songs we're selling, and we know that that doesn't necessarily correspond to how many subscribers we have. So our bottom line changes. But, yeah, we try to use Twitter and Facebook and email and online web shows to reach as many people as possible. We are aware that some people just every once in a while type in Pomplamoose into Google and see what the most recent video is.
You know what you do? You ask them. All these guys, you ask them. Whatever, say, please comment, rate, and subscribe to my video. And that you see that on everything.
That was an amazing program. I really want to thank Jim Lauterbach of Revision 3, David Prager of course, founder of Revision 3, co-founder of Revision 3 Indignation, Tara Long of Destructoid, one of my favorite shows, Dan Brown of Dan 3.0, Dan 3.0, and Jack Conte of Pomplamoose. And now, this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.